unto me the secret of the universe, scribbled on a slip of wrinkled paper. A weight had been lifted from my shoulders, a weight of which I hadn't been aware until it was gone. I wanted to hug someone. I wanted to burst into glorious song.
"Hmm," I said.
"Yes, I suppose that's one way of looking at it." I hadn't noticed until now that Hob had stopped strolling and begun cantering. Yes, cantering! It seemed as if a little of my elation had rubbed off on him. "What do you know about Poppy Mandrill?" I asked suddenly. "In my experience, it is often a bolt from the blue that shakes loose the biggest avalanche."
"Everyone's afraid of her," Hob replied without batting an eye.
"Everyone?"
"Well, I'm not, of course,"
Hob said, jutting his chin out.
"But I only know her to see her."
I couldn't resist.
"Then how do you know everyone's afraid of her?"
"Because I keep my ears open," Hob said, "at funerals." I realized at once, of course, that I had, almost accidentally, tapped into a vast reservoir. If there's one place where people speak with unguarded tongues, it's at a funeral. Emotion, and especially grief, loosens tongues even more than alcohol. I'll bet there have been more truths told over an open coffin than in all the confession boxes in Christendom.
"Do you really?" I asked admiringly.
Hob fairly preened.
"Mrs. Perry said that to Mrs. Bellany at old Mr. Arkwright's funeral. As soon as Poppy Mandrill came into the room, everybody moved away from her, as if she had the Black Plague or something."
"Perhaps it was respect," I suggested.
"Far," Hob said. "They were afraid of her. Mrs. Perry leaned over and whispered to Mrs. Bellany. They're all afraid of that. I'm not allowed to say the next word, but you must know the one I mean. I heard it with my own ears."
"You're a very clever lad, Hob," I said, and he nearly burst into flames.
"I knew it," he said, hugging himself. "I knew it."
"Well, you are," I assured him. "What else have you heard? About Poppy Mandrill, I mean. We can get to the others later."
"She's with the Puddle Lane Little Theatre."
Hob rolled his eyes as if I would understand.
"They put on plays in the town hall, pantomimes at Christmas, you know."
I did indeed. We suffered in much the same way at Bishop's Lacey, with the same kind of dreary and awkward but compulsory comedies.
"But why on earth would the dead Orlando be dressed for a Christmas pantomime?
It was June, for goodness sake. Rehearsals wouldn't even begin for months, and as for dress rehearsals, well, they were simply out of the question at this time of year."
"Is anyone holding a masquerade?" I asked.
"I don't know that word," Hob said.
"A masquerade? A dress-up party. Costumes, highwaymen, for instance, gents in powdered wigs, ladies in silk dresses like tents at the fete, and black beauty spots stuck on their cheeks."
"Ugh," Hob said.
"Doesn't sound very beautiful to me. I've never heard of such a thing."
"Why are they afraid of Poppy Mandrill?" I asked, trying to get my line of questioning back onto the track.
"She's bossy," Hob said. "Always giving people orders."
"Isn't that what a theatre director is supposed to do?" I asked, only half seriously.
"Not in church,"
Hob exclaimed, his eyes widening and his hackles rising visibly.
"Did you actually see that happen?"
I asked. Hob nodded several times to make his point.
"Only once," he said. "She shouted at the vicar, right in the middle of his sermon."
"Good Lord," I blurted. Even I wouldn't have dared such sacrilege.
"Do you remember what she said?" "She said, 'Cut the cackle, vicar, I've a train to catch.'"
"Was this on Palm Sunday, by any chance?" I asked. "About 3 months ago."
"How did you know that?"
Hob asked. "We all had our palm fronds in our hands, Lizzie Pleasance tried to strangle me with hers. I took mine home and made a straw soldier out of it. I couldn't help wondering idly what Hob would have thought if I'd told him I usually twisted my own annual palm frond into a hangman's noose. Actually, naming the date was a brilliant bit of deduction on my part. I knew by bitter experience that the Palm Sunday morning service was the longest in the Book of Common Prayer. The Gospel was taken from Matthew chapter 27, which, as I recalled, ran more than 1,000 words. I knew this because I had counted them, one by one, following with my index finger, as our own vicar, Denwin Richardson, had read them aloud on several Palm Sundays back home in Bishop's Lacey. "You lot are getting off easily," he had told us at confirmation class. "Had you been unfortunate enough to have lived in about 1550, in the time of King Edward VI, who died at the age of 15, younger than you there, Ted Pullimore, yes, you, Ted, and who died coughing up green, black, and pink matter, leading some to believe he had been poisoned, you'd have had to sit still 3 times longer than we do nowadays. In those days, the Gospel reading for Palm Sunday combined Matthew's chapters 26 and 27, and would have lasted somewhere between 20 minutes and half an hour. Fortunately, the many editors of the Book of Common Prayer, in their wisdom, took mercy upon our poor, aching sitters and slashed the reading substantially." That's what I loved about Denwin Richardson. He simply oozed history. "And what about the dead man?" I asked Hob. "Orlando. Did you know him?"
"Orlando?" Hob snorted noisily. "Everybody knew Orlando."
"Everybody except me," I said. "I don't even know his last name."
"Whitbread," Hob said. "Orlando Whitbread. His father used to be the rector of St. Mildred's in the Marsh."
"Whitbread? You could have knocked me over with a bit of goose down."
"Canon Whitbread?" I asked.
"Not Canon Whitbread. Not the one who..."
"Choked on a rope," Hob said.
"Yes, that's the one. I helped Daddy embalm him."
Chapter 6. What can you possibly say to a child who has helped his father pump preservatives into the carotid artery of a hanged murderer? Precious little, I discovered. There are no words suitable for the occasion, no words to convey my shock, my awe, my admiration, or my jealousy.
"Are you surprised?" Hob asked. "You seem surprised."
"Not at all," I said, leaping madly aboard the opportunity. "Tell me about it."
"You look surprised," Hob persisted.
"All right, then. I'm surprised, astonished, flabbergasted, in fact. Tell me about it."
"Perhaps when I know you better," Hob said.
Where did this little lad get his spunkiness from? What crazy corner of the universe animated his mind?
"All right," I said. "I don't mind. I'm really not all that interested anyway."
Hob said nothing, but gave me a look that suggested I'd just been caught poaching his father's chickens. If undertakers, in fact, had chickens. I could think of various reasons why they might and might not keep poultry, none of them suitable for discussion with anyone other than the most confidential friends, and even then... But before I could stop him, Hob was loping off toward home.
"Farewell,"
he called back over his shoulder. Had I scared him off by being too familiar? Well, no matter. But I didn't think of the obvious question until he had already disappeared round a corner.
"Hob, wait," I called.
But he didn't hear me, or pretended not to. I could have run after him, but there was no time. "Never mind," I decided. "There will be other opportunities." Meanwhile, Feely, Daffy, and Dogger would already be worrying about me. Or would they? I could never quite be sure.
In any case, I needn't have bothered. By the time I got back to the church, Feely was still lost in the art of fugue, which was now nearing its end, or what passed as its end, since J.S. Bach had never finished the thing. At the point where he had abruptly given it up, Bach had noted on the manuscript that at this point the composer had died, which was, Daffy said, a colossal joke that no one had yet spotted, that somewhere up among the stars Bach was still waiting for someone to laugh. I gave a quiet chuckle at the thought, and old Johann Sebastian, from somewhere beyond Pluto, raised two fingers and gave me the V for victory sign. Dogger and Daffy were sitting side by side in a back pew, eyes closed, hands folded on tummies like a pair of well-fed pigeons on a ledge at Westminster Abbey, listening contentedly to the music. I slid in quietly beside them, and although Dogger opened the corner of one eye, Daffy may as well have been somewhere in the far-off Fiji Islands. I walked my fingers slowly and quietly across the pew as if they were a hump-backed spider. With my forefinger, I tapped out a message in code on the back of Dogger's hand. A quick touch for a dot and a long touch for a dash. Jolly good thing I had been forced to learn the Morse system at Miss Bodicote's in Canada. Dot, dash, dash, dot. Dot, dash, dot. Dash, 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 and so forth, until I had spelled out the letters P-R-O-G-R-E-S-S. For just a fraction of a moment, I thought he hadn't got it, but then I saw his head incline by about a 64th of an inch. If you hadn't known Dogger, you'd have sworn he hadn't budged. Now his hand was lightly touching mine. E-X-C-E-L-L-E-N-T, his fingers tapped. A warm glow came over me, and I hoped I wasn't flushing. I sneaked a glance at Dogger, but his eyes were still closed. How noble he looked! How like a god! The art of fugue ended abruptly, as I knew it would, cut off in mid-flight, just like Orlando Whitbread. And come to think of it, just like his father, late of St. Mildred's in the Marsh. As the music came to a stop, the organ made the usual little dying noises as the air left its lungs. Somewhere behind the tall, ornamental pipes, leather bellows collapsed, and all the tiny tin and wooden arteries, deprived of wind, wheezed into a restless silence. For a moment, the three of us, Daffy, Dogger, and I, sat in that uneasy vacuum that always comes into existence when the music ends, each one of us reluctant to be the first to speak. In the end, it was me. "We'd better get back to the Oak and Pheasant," I said. "We'll need to book rooms. I don't expect we'll be going home until further notice."
"Those arrangements are already seen to, Miss Flavia," Dogger said. "I shall go fetch the car."
We had left the Rolls parked a short distance up the river at the boat rental establishment. "Good old Dogger," I said, patting his hand. "You are the one fixed point in a changing age." He smiled and vanished.
"Sherlock Holmes," Daffy said, her eyes popping open. "His last bow. There's an east wind coming all the same, such a wind as never blew on England yet. It will be cold and bitter, Watson, and a good many of us may wither before its blast."
Even though she was quoting from memory, Daffy's words shook me to the core. I was seized with a sudden crawling chill. Instead of the word England, she might have said, "such a wind as never blew on us." Us meaning the Deluce family. With Father's death, the blight had already begun. This happy holiday was no more than the gentle and deceiving slope at the lip of the pit. There was a clatter behind us on the stone steps, and Feely appeared.
"Come along, slugs," she said, meaning Daffy and me. "I'm famished."
Feely was like that. She could switch her attention from Gregorian chant to the state of her own gut in half of a horsefly's heartbeat. I had come to realize that I simply didn't understand my older sister, and I never would. As we came out of the church, I noticed that Orlando's body had been removed from the river bank. Constable Otter was nowhere in sight, nor was Miss Mandrill. A cluster of women in house dresses stood on, or close to, the spot where Orlando had until lately lain leaking into the grass. Even at this distance, and against the wind, I could hear the sound of their magpie chatter. Back at the inn, we found that our rooms had already been assigned. Feely was to be given the best bedroom, a low timbered chamber at the front of the building, which faced the church, and in which, or so it was said, Queen Elizabeth I had slept on one of her many progresses round her kingdom.
"Is there a single bedroom in all of England in which she didn't?" Daffy asked sourly.
But the landlord, who was accustomed to such impertinence, shot back, "Yes, mine." Daffy had the good grace to laugh, although I knew her well enough to recognize that it was insincere. Daffy had been given a cozy little chamber, up one step, on the west side of the building, which, in the days of good Queen Bess, had been a small country house.
"Longer daylight for reading," she said.
Although she had spotted a small library, which was little more than a couple of shelves banged together halfway up the stairs, she had written it off at a glance.
"Anthony Hopeless," she said, "Weeder, Sabatini, Michael Arlen, Ryder Haggard, and not so much as a single scribble by the Divine Charles," meaning Dickens, of course, to whom she had constructed a small shrine in her bedroom at Buckshaw. Before coming away on our holiday, I had suggested she have the whole set-up mounted on an ox-cart, as they did with their portable altars in the Middle Ages.
"We can tow it behind the rolls," I told her. "Think how handy it would be to have the whole lot of it, portrait of the Divine Charles, candles, snuffers, incense, first editions of Bleak House and the Pickwick Papers, all right there at your fingertips in case you suffer withdrawal symptoms." Whereupon I had been driven from the breakfast table in a hail of bath buns, which, considering that they had been baked by Mrs. Mullet, was a good deal more life-threatening than it sounds. As for me, I was to be quartered in a tiny room at the rear of the inn, which had once, the landlord assured me, been a small minstrel's gallery.
"Don't worry if you hear strange voices singing in the night," he told me in a confidential tone. "They're mostly harmless, even though the last lady what heard 'em went stark mad," he added, dropping into a dialect stage whisper, "and had to be put in a straitjacket."
I ignored him. A glance out of the narrow single window told me that the only voices I was likely to hear would be those of the old gaffers sitting round the trestle tables in the sunken garden with their tankards of ale. I raised the fly-blown Holland blind to let more light into this murky chamber. The furnishings were sparse, to say the least. A small bed, complete with a chamber pot, a cheap wooden table with ewer and pitcher, a safety lamp with candle and glass chimney, presumably for emergencies in the night, a chair that was straight out of a painting by Vincent van Gogh, a sink that had seen goodness knows what, a hot plate and tin kettle, and an oval mirror with yellowed glass. Dogger was already back, bringing with him my small travelling case from the rolls. Unlike Daffy, who had insisted on dragging along a wooden packing case containing the works of Charles Dickens, complete in 26 fat, red, heavy leather-bound volumes, I had brought only the bare necessities: a toothbrush and Taylor's Principles and Practice of Medical Jurisprudence. In order to keep down the weight, I had selected only the second volume of that great work, the one containing the poisons. I waited until the landlord, with his hand-rubbing ghost stories, was out of earshot, and even then I closed the door.
"Dogger," I asked, "where do they bury executed murderers?"
"Well, Miss Flavia,"
he said.
That depends upon the times. In the 18th century, they were sometimes left hanging on the gibbet. The birds took care of the rest.
I gave a delicious shiver at the thought.
Some were buried at a crossroads,
Dogger went on,
as were suicides, until the practice was abolished by an Act of Parliament in the 1820s.
Why a crossroads? I asked.
It was believed that the meeting of four ways would reduce the chance of the ghost finding its way back home.
And nowadays? In my excitement, I could hardly get the question out.
Nowadays, Dogger replied, the bodies of executed murderers are the property of the Crown. They are buried in perforated coffins, in unmarked graves, within the precincts of the prison in which their sentence was carried out.
Not handed over to the family? Not turned over to the undertaker?
Not unless directed otherwise by the sheriff of the county, Dogger answered. Once buried, exhumation requires a formal license from the Home Office, which must be signed personally by the Home Secretary, although I understand that this is frowned upon and would be granted in only the most extraordinary circumstances.
My mind was floundering to stay afloat. Unless Hobb was a downright liar, it was simply not possible for him to have been present at the embalming of Canon Whitbread. In the first place, if the canon had been hanged at one of His Majesty's prisons, the body would not have been embalmed. A perforated coffin could mean only one thing, that the speediest possible decomposition was desired. Embalming would only prolong it. Which left only a handful of possibilities. That the body of the hanged canon had been turned over to the family after execution, but before burial, upon receipt of a direct order from the sheriff. That the body on Mr. Nightingale's slab had not been Canon Whitbread, or that Canon Whitbread had not, in fact, been executed. I couldn't contain my excitement.
"Where was Canon Whitbread buried?" I asked.
"Ah," said Dogger, "that is the question, is it not? We shall have to find that out."
"We, Dogger and me, the two of us, on the case together." My heart began to glow like a pot-bellied wood stove in a logger's cabin.
"Where shall we begin?" I managed to say.
"With the parishioners of St. Mildred's," Dogger answered. "It is a fact often overlooked by the law that when it comes to murder, the parishioners know all the answers."
"Did you say murder, Dogger?"
"I did indeed."
Now, suddenly, I was glowing like the midsummer sun. Dogger had, independently, come to the same conclusion I had.
"We mustn't discuss specific details," I whispered, "in order not to contaminate each other's evidence."
"Of course," Dogger agreed. "I was about to say the same thing myself, Miss Flavia."
I let out a long, noisy breath, a hiss of almost serpent pleasure. The murderer of Orlando Whitbread was doomed. From that very moment, he hadn't the chance of a snowman in Hades to escape the team of Dogger and Deluse. I desperately wanted to rub noses with my new partner, but I didn't dare. Eskimo kisses would have to wait until we were more firmly established.
"And now, miss," Dogger said, turning to my single piece of luggage, "shall we unpack the poisons?"
Chapter 7. The poisons to which Dogger referred were those discussed in the fat blue volume of Taylor's Medical Jurisprudence in its 9th edition, which I believe I have already mentioned. "Sorry for the wait," I said, as Dogger hoisted my suitcase onto the bed. I knew perfectly well that mine was nothing compared with the ox cart of books dear Daffy had dragged along. I trusted that, in Dogger's mind, I would seem thoughtful by comparison.
"A good book," he said, squaring up the heavy volume reverently on the bedside table. is the precious lifeblood of a master spirit, embalmed and treasured up on purpose to a life beyond life? Or so at least says Mr. Milton in his Areopagitica, he added.
I nodded wisely in agreement, even though I wasn't quite sure who Mr. Milton was, what he meant by the remark, or what his Areopagitica might happen to be. Still, any quotation with the word embalmed in it can never be a bore.
Dogger, I said, what do you think?
But Dogger stuck up a warning hand, palm toward me, the universal symbol for hush, or perhaps shut up.
I shut up.
Incredibly, I had not heard the footsteps on the stairs outside. Fortunately, Dogger had.
"I shall find a tackle shop, Miss Flavia," he said, keeping his hand in the air, "and some suitable rods, if we are to be detained for a day or two in order to assist Constable Otter. I am quite confident there can be no harm in a bit of fishing."
On the last word, he gave me a broad wink, and I had to clap a hand over my mouth to keep from giggling.
"Oh, must we?" I said, falling into the role as Jean Simmons might have done. "I detest fishing."
"I dare say," Dogger replied with a poker-straight face, "that you will feel quite differently when you catch something."
I hugged myself with delight. This was living. The shadows of the past 6 months, at least most of them, vanished at the prospect of... well, I wasn't quite sure what, but reeling in a murderer would certainly keep our minds occupied.
"I suppose you're right," I said, trying to inject unwillingness into my voice.
But even as I spoke, Dogger was moving slowly and silently toward the door. When he reached it, he seized the knob and gave it an easy, fluid twist.
"Oh, Mrs. Palmer," he said. "You startled me. I didn't realize you were here."
"You old fox," I thought. "You clever old fox." "Oh, Mr. Dogger," the landlord's wife said.
"I was just about to say the same. We've gone and startled one another, haven't we? I was just coming up to see if anything was required." Another old fox, I thought, or rather, another old vixen.
I was keenly aware that I was watching two old masters at work.
"Nothing, thank you," Dogger said, pretending to brush a fleck of dust from the suitcase.
"And you, dearie?"
Mrs. Palmer asked, fixing me with the most awful, leering, counterfeit grin.
"Anything to make you comfy?"
I had once made a solemn pledge to flay alive and use their skin for a horse blanket the next person who dared to call me dearie. Her awful word hung in the stale bedroom air. And then,
"Just a bit of quiet, thank you," I heard my mouth saying. "I have the most awful headache."
It was the first time in my life I had ever used this Neanderthal excuse, but I knew, even as I said it, why at least 2,000 generations of females have employed those very words, or at least their equivalent, in whatever language they may have spoken. As an argument, the phrase was unassailable, a conversational stone wall. Who, for instance, could ever prove you hadn't one? As a sword shrouded in velvet, a gentle weapon, it was probably unequalled. 6 simple words, of which all but 2 were of a single syllable, and yet which fairly oozed accusation. "I have the most awful headache." I knew that it was unfair, a cheat, a deceit, and, well, why not put it plainly, a lie. At the same time, I rejoiced in knowing that it had wandered in from some distant room in my brain.
"I shall be all right," I said. "It's just the shock of..."
I let my voice trail off into nothingness.
"Flavia, you fibber."
"There, there, dearie," Mrs. Palmer said. "I understand. I've been taken that way myself on many an occasion." There was that word again. I had somehow to restrain myself. In my mind, I pulled from my pocket a needle and a reel of fishing line. I imagined popping the end of the tough black fiber into my mouth to moisten it, then squinting as I pushed it through the eye of the needle, which I shoved in through my lower lip, out through my upper lip, pulled it tight, followed with another loop, and another, and another. When I was finished, my mouth looked like one of those stitched-up shrunken heads that are brought back by explorers from the Amazonian jungle. I was proud of my handiwork. Against all odds, I had managed to keep my mouth shut. Mrs. Palmer was giving me what I believe is called a quizzical look. "Shoo," I told her with my mind. "Buzz off. Go away. Vanish. Vamoose. Get lost. Take a powder." And, by the jawbone of Jupiter, it worked. Mrs. Palmer blinked. "I'd best be getting back, then, if there's nothing I can do," she said, dusting her hands as if to signal she was finished with me. "Thank you, Mrs. Palmer," Dogger said, and I thought I heard a muffled humph as she clumped noisily down the stairs. "Back to the poisons," I said when she was gone and the door was firmly shut. "Back to the poisons," Dogger echoed. I have to admit that I was reluctant to tell him what I'd done, but after only a couple of false starts, I found myself explaining in detail how I had used my handkerchief to swab a sample of liquid from the corpse's lips. I needn't have worried.
"Excellent," Dogger said. "You were thinking of the diatoms, no doubt."
"No," I admitted. "I was thinking of potassium cyanide, prussic acid, and peraldehyde."
Dogger nodded.
"Quite right," he said. "The three P's. Very proper. We shall test for those also."
"Tell me about the diatoms," I said. When the speaker was Dogger, I was more than willing to be instructed.
"The diatoms," Dogger explained, and I could see that he was enjoying this, "are a vast species of microscopic algae belonging to the class Bacilla aurea physei, which are notable for secreting a hard outer skeleton of siliceous matter."
"Hold on," I said. "Are you telling me they secrete a shell of sand?"
"Well, virtually, in its hydrated form, of course. Their cell walls are of the same material."
"Like tiny army tanks?"
"Precisely."
"The point being?" I could hardly contain myself.
"The point being that in cases of drowning, the presence or absence of diatoms in the lungs may well indicate whether or not the victim was breathing when he or she went into the water."
I wrinkled my brow. "I don't quite follow you," I said. Dogger reached into an inner pocket and pulled out a small black notebook. After flipping through a great many pages, upon which were written a great many notes, in his tiny, meticulous hand, oh, how I wish I could have read it all, he came at last to a blank page. Unscrewing the cap of his fountain pen, he began to draw a series of small triangles, ellipses, and circles, then filled them in with elaborate but regular patterns of cells and chambers, some like snowflakes or miniature honeycombs, or snooker balls in their triangular racks, or the hugely magnified fly's eyes in one of those endless instructional films we were made to watch in St. Tancred's Parish Hall. "Diatoms are abundant in both fresh and salt water," Dogger said. "If we analyze the residue on your handkerchief..." And suddenly the light went on. "We can tell if he was breathing. We can tell if he was murdered."
"Perhaps," Dogger said. "Putting aside the bruise on the neck for a moment, there were no marks of restraint on the visible parts of his body. It is remarkably difficult to hold an unwilling victim under water. Ropes are usually required."
"Or handcuffs," I added.
"Or handcuffs," Dogger agreed.
although it's the extremities of the limbs that flail about, so that abrasions generally tend to be found on the wrists and ankles.
That makes sense, I said, and it did. How did Dogger know all these things?
All that remains, said Dogger, is a proper chemical analysis.
We'd better get on with it, I said, before the evidence evaporates.
Possibly with reference to the cyanide, the prussic acid and the peraldehyde, but as for the diatoms, there is no urgency whatever. The frustules for which we are searching consist virtually of glass, which will last for millions of years. I suggest we have time for tea.
But I don't want tea, I protested. I want to roll up my sleeves and get to work. It took me a moment to see what Dogger was smiling at. In my light summer dress, I had no sleeves worth speaking of to roll up.
And so do I, Miss Flavia, he said. But first we shall have to assemble certain, philosophical instruments.
Because philosophical instruments was the phrase used by Dr. Watson to describe certain of Sherlock Holmes's chemical apparatuses, I knew what Dogger meant.
Of course, I said, we must assemble our philosophical instruments,
not yet having the faintest idea what these might be.
Well, we can boil our own water anyway, I said, pointing to the electric hot plate and tired-looking tin kettle that sat on a table in front of the window.
An excellent start, Dogger said, rubbing his hands together. I shall be back in a jiff.
Back in a jiff? What was the world coming to? That Dogger should use such slang was unthinkable. But before I could remark upon it, he was gone.
I went to the window and peered down through the curtain. A few seconds later, Dogger appeared in the inn-yard, walked casually to the parked rolls, removed a couple of items from the boot, and retraced his steps.
"You're very cheerful, Dogger," I twitted him as he came back into the room. "Did you win something on the dogs or the horses?"
"I am not a betting man, Miss Flavia, except upon the great game of life and death. In my own turns at the table, I have been most fortunate to date.
I ought to have known better.
I'm sorry, Dogger, I said. I didn't mean to.
Nor did I, said Dogger. It is time, I think, to make our first move.
And with that, he placed two objects on the bed. The first was a man's black leather travel case. The other I recognized as a first aid kit, from the boot of the rolls. From his pocket he produced the powerful torch normally kept in the car's glove box.
"Now then," he said, "one thing more."
He opened the door and, after looking both ways, stepped into the hall and vanished to the left, which direction, I knew, led only to the WC, otherwise it was a blind corridor. There was a silence, and then came the gush of a flushing toilet. There are times when it isn't polite to listen, but the proximity of the water closet to my bedroom at the Oak and Pheasant made such niceties difficult to observe. A moment later, Dogger was back.
"Always flush when you are up to no good," he said with a solemn face. "It puts them off the scent."
I couldn't believe my ears. Was Dogger making a joke? He was talking to me almost as if I were an equal.
From behind his back he produced a yellow metal tin.
"There is no good landlord, or landlady for that matter, from Land's End to John O'Groats, who doesn't lay in a good supply of drain cleaner."
He held out the tin for my inspection. "Drain bane," I read aloud. "Is that really the name of it?"
"Unhappily, yes," Dogger said, "but fortunately for us, it is nothing more than sodium hydroxide putting on airs."
Sodium hydroxide! I clapped my hands together. Caustic soda to the masses, but good old NaOH to those of us who are lucky enough to be chemists.
As if I were home again in my lab at Buckshaw, a great calm came over me.
"Where do we begin?" I asked,
suddenly breathless at the prospect.
"I suggest we prepare the diatoms," Togger replied.
I dug into my pocket and extracted the handkerchief, taking great care to keep it balled up to protect the evidence. I handed it over to Dogger, realizing, even as I did so, that this frail bit of linen might well become the noose round the neck of some person or persons as yet unknown. It was an eerie feeling, but a pleasant one. It would be nice to believe that justice plays no favorites. To my surprise, Dogger set the handkerchief aside. Well, not exactly aside, but he pushed it gently into a glass drinking tumbler which he took from the black travel case.
"First things first," he said. "First things, in this case, being distilled water."
He half-filled the kettle with water from the small sink in the corner and placed it on the hot plate. Setting aside the lid, he replaced it with the glass chimney from the candle holder, capping this with a second tumbler from the travel case.
"Almost a perfect fit," he said, switching on the hot plate. "It will do."
"You've done this before," I observed.
"No," Dogger said. "I'm afraid I am improvising."
"Improvising is half the fun," I said, "if it works."
"It is indeed," Dogger agreed.
Chapter 8. It wasn't long before the kettle's steam began rising into the lamp chimney and condensing on the colder glass. Dogger let it boil for 2.5 minutes before switching off the hot plate, by which time the inside of the chimney was completely filled with steam, its inner surfaces streaming water droplets like a rain-lashed window. With a swift movement, Dogger seized the makeshift apparatus and, removing it from atop the kettle, flipped it over and placed it gently on the table. The drinking glass was now on the bottom, the inverted chimney on the top. Already the condensation was forming beads, running down the inside of the glass, dripping into the tumbler. "That's our distilled water," I said, ticking it off on my fingers.
"We shall set aside a bit of it for our cyanide and peraldehyde experiments," he said, tipping a couple of ounces into a drinking glass from the bedside table.
"Do we have enough?" I asked.
"We shan't require a great deal," Dogger said, decanting the remaining water carefully into the glass containing my handkerchief, and tamping it down with the end of his fountain pen until the whole wad was thoroughly wetted. "The evidence is microscopic."
"What's next?"
"We shall leave it to percolate for a while," Dogger said.
Time becomes glacial when you're impatient, and after just a few minutes I found myself sitting on my hands to keep from fidgeting.
"Shall we get on with our cyanide and peraldehyde testing?" Dogger suggested with a gentle smile, as he took down a white stoneware soap dish from a shelf above the sink.
I hugged myself with joy.
"Because potassium cyanide, KCN, would have been converted by Orlando's stomach acids to prussic acid, HCN, these tests were simple. We could, of course, have produced the required picric acid with a handful of aspirin tablets in sulfuric acid, but we quickly decided upon an easier method. A couple of grams of sodium bicarbonate and a few drops of picric acid antiseptic, both from the first aid kit Dogger had brought from the rolls, would do the trick nicely." I watched as Dogger carefully washed and dried the soap dish, tipped into it an ounce or so of the solution in which my handkerchief was soaking, then added a few drops of the antiseptic to the sample. As I was half expecting it would, the fluid, due to the formation of potassium isopurpurate, quickly took on a faint reddish brick color.
"Interesting," I said, trying to contain my excitement.
"Cyanide, the presence of which would, in itself, suggest accidental poisoning, suicide, or murder." Dogger nodded. "And now for the peraldehyde. I've also taken the liberty of siphoning a small quantity of battery acid, sulfuric, of course, from the rolls,"
he said, producing a small glass bottle which I recognized at once as having formerly contained smelling salts in the car's glove box.
"You are amazing, Dogger!"
I clapped my hands together. "Thank you, Miss Flavia," he said. "Amazing is a word for wizards. I prefer to think of myself as merely practical." Because Dogger's gentle rebukes were always as warm as honey, I treasured them. I vowed never to use the word again.
"Would you care to do the honors?" he asked, and I knew that I was forgiven my momentary indiscretion.
After heating the bottle gently in the steam from the kettle, I removed, with great care, the stopper of the salt bottle and decanted a few drops of the sulfuric acid into the soap dish, which contained the small sample of what I now thought of as my handkerchief water. Just as the picric acid signaled the presence of cyanide by turning red in the first sample, so did the sulfuric acid tell us we were in the presence of peraldehyde by going yellow with a greenish tinge. Dogger and I looked at each other, snug as two bugs in a rug. "Cyanide," I said again, "and peraldehyde."
"It certainly seems so," Dogger agreed. "And now for our friends, the diatoms. If you will be so good as to prepare a solution of the sodium hydroxide, a couple of cubic centimetres ought to be sufficient."
Taking the now empty drinking tumbler from our makeshift distilling apparatus, I placed it in the bottom of the sink and poured into it some of the remaining hot water from the kettle. One needed to be extremely careful at this game. Dogger nodded approvingly as I raised the window sash. Sodium hydroxide crystals, upon contact with water, generate sudden tremendous heat, the so-called exothermic reaction, resulting in a furious foaming, which explains why they are so highly regarded in the unclogging of stubborn drains. Because of the caustic nature of the stuff, it is necessary to protect the skin and clothing from unexpected splashes. I loved it that Dogger didn't tell me to be careful.
"May I borrow your driving gloves?" I asked.
Did Dogger raise an eyebrow?
Perhaps by the width of a hair, but he hid it well. "Of course you may, Miss Flavia," he replied, and fished them from his jacket pocket.
As I slipped them onto my hands, I marvelled at the soft luxury of the gloves, which Dogger had once told me were stitched from the skins of young hornless goats from the Cape of Good Hope. "Poor babies," I thought, as I wiggled my fingers into position. "I'd better be careful not to damage them." Uncapping the tin of drain bane, I tipped a few crystals of the stuff into the glass of water from the kettle. They sank to the bottom. A few more crystals, and they began to fizz. A few more, and... I stopped abruptly. Like a dose of stomach salts, the stuff was suddenly foaming fiercely up the sides of the glass, but fortunately it stopped just before reaching the lip.
"Perfect," Dogger said. Until that moment I hadn't realized he was watching me. "As for the required glassware, I have taken the liberty of bringing up the bud vase from Miss Harriet's Rolls-Royce."
How I longed to hug him, not just for thinking of how to provide a makeshift test tube, but for still thinking of the Rolls as belonging to my late mother. In the days when she was still alive, this small glass trumpet from Liberty's had been one of two in the car, which my father had kept perpetually supplied with roses from the garden at Buckshaw. The thought of it tugged at something inside me, but I didn't want to give in to emotion in front of Dogger.
"Brilliant," was all I could manage. "What shall we use for a stopper?"
But Dogger had already thought of that.
"Candle wax," he said, reaching for the hand lamp whose glass shade we had already put to such good use.
He plucked the candle from its socket, held its butt end over the hot plate, and turned on the switch. Rotating it as it warmed, he soon had a teardrop of wax, the size of a penny, ready to drop.
"If you'll be so kind as to hold this for a moment," he said,
and taking the glass containing the submerged handkerchief, He gave it a final stir and a good poke with his pen. Having done so, he poured some of the liquid contents into the bud vase and handed it to me. With thumbs and first two fingers, I worked the wax to form a perfect plug, then pressed it into the top of the vase.
"Watertight," I said, and Dogger nodded.
"Now for a centrifuge," he said quietly, almost as if to himself.
"Centrifuge?" At home in my laboratory at Buckshaw, I had the lovely professional centrifuge that had been brought from Germany by my late Uncle Tarquin. With an electrical motor powerful enough to swing an ox until doomsday at 2,000 revolutions per minute, or until the electrical power was cut off, whichever came first. But here in a miserable bedroom at the Oak and Pheasant, what were we to do? A small light dawned in my brain. I was already grinning from ear to ear.
"The blind cord!" I blurted.
Then, gaining control of myself, I said in softer tones, and with considerably less volume,
"I think the cord from the blind will serve admirably."
The look on Dogger's face was worth a sultan's ransom, as if his horse had won the derby. If this wasn't pride, it was something very much like it.
"Quite right," he said. "I'm sure the good Mrs. Palmer won't mind, as long as we leave everything as we found it."
He stepped to the window, lowered the blind, brought out his penknife, selected the smallest blade, and before you could say, "I name this racehorse Jack Robinson," had detached the flaxen cord. With a firm reef knot, left over right, right over left, granny knots be gone, he fastened the cord firmly to the tapered neck of the bud vase.
"Now for the acrobatics."
He took up a position at the foot of the bed.
"Please sit in the corner and mind your head."
As I retreated to the chair in the corner, Dogger seized the cord in its center, and like an American cowboy about to lasso a calf, began swinging it and the bud vase with its precious cargo in a circle round his head. As the speed accelerated, Dogger let out more and more cord until the glass was coming within a foot of each of the walls. I watched for a while until, as always happens when you're watching someone swing a rope, I began to grow bored.
"How long will it take?" I asked.
15 minutes, I reckon," he said.
"I reckon? Was this meant to be a joke? And a cowboy joke at that? Was I supposed to laugh?"
I smiled to cover all the possibilities and returned to my watching. I understood perfectly what was taking place, of course. Inside the bud vase, the diatoms, if there were any, because of their relatively heavy siliceous composition, were overcoming both buoyant and frictional forces of the liquid solution as centrifugal force rammed them relentlessly and tightly into the very bottom of the bud vase.
"Shall I spell you for a while?" I asked Dogger,
and he nodded with a look of what I guessed was gratitude. I ducked in under the rope and synchronized my motions with his. Like a country station master handing off the right-of-way token to the engine driver of the Flying Scotsman at speed, the transfer was perfection. Dogger stepped neatly out of the way and perched on the edge of the chair.
"This is harder than it looks," I said, after a couple of minutes.
My arm was already beginning to ache.
"Sustained muscular action often is," Dogger said. "Without prior training, that is. Such fatigue is due largely to a surplus of chloride, potassium, lactic acid and magnesium, caused by muscular contraction and a simultaneous insufficiency of creatine phosphate, glycogen, and adenosine triphosphate."
Why had no one ever put it so plainly? It suddenly made such perfect sense. Muscle power needed to be chemically provided, and at the same time, muscular waste products efficiently removed, to allow Harry Plunkett to lift his father's Clydesdale horse, Colossus,
clear off the ground for charity every August at the Hindley Goose and Gooseberry Show. My arms were feeling suddenly less heavy. Round and round the bud vase flew on the end of its cord, producing an audible humming noise. I was an angel, and the glass container my oversized halo. But wait, I was now being transformed into a helicopter on the verge of lifting off. If I could, I would fly out the window, across the road to the church, and hover there, an eye in the sky, getting a first-hand view of the landscape in which Orlando Whitbread had met his bitter end. There would be no need to wait for Hobbs' aerial snapshots from the chemists. "That ought to be sufficient," Dogger said, snapping me abruptly out of my daydream. I slowed the high-speed missile, letting it descend gently, little by little, until it came almost to rest, rotating slowly and idly at the end of the cord.
"Now then," Dogger said, "the sodium hydroxide ought to have digested any organic matter which was present in your sample."
By my sample, he was referring to the slimy liquid I had wiped from Orlando's mouth,
"leaving only the siliceous cell walls and outer skeletons of the diatoms, presuming, of course, that diatoms were present."
As he spoke, he poured off into the sink the excess liquid, which was quite clear, leaving only the slightest trace of a foggy residue in the bottom of the bud vase.
"And if they weren't present?" I asked, knowing the answer perfectly well, but wanting to hear it again from Dogger's lips.
"If they weren't present, then we can certainly make the case that our deceased friend was already dead when he entered the water. All that remains for us now is to improvise a microscope."
Improvise a microscope? I think my heart stopped. Was all this to be for nothing?
"Which is quite easily done," Dogger said, ignoring my open mouth.
Taking the torch, he switched it on and stood it on the table so that its beam was striking the ceiling. Then, slipping two fingers into his waistcoat pocket, he removed a tiny object and held it up for my inspection.
"A paperclip?" I asked.
"Indeed. The humble paperclip, in certain circumstances, can be of more practical use than a magic wand."
And without another word, he opened out one end of the metal clip, and with fingers as deft as any surgeon's, twisted it into a tiny loop. From the first aid kit, he removed a small jar of petroleum jelly, into which he dipped the wire circle.
"Now," he said, taking a deep breath, "shall we rake out the contents of our vase, whatever they may be, onto the bottom of this?"
This was a small graduated measuring glass, which he was removing from the first aid kit. He turned it upside down and placed it on the table beside the torch. With a wooden tongue depressor, also from the first aid kit, I scraped out the residue from the vase and spread it thinly on the bottom of the glass. Dogger picked up the glass and slipped it, inverted, over the glowing lens of the torch. Drawing the loop of his paperclip along the inside of the glass lamp chimney, which still contained a small puddle of distilled water, he pulled it out and held it up for my inspection. Suspended in the loop of the clip was a single drop of water, which sparkled like a diamond in the light from the window.
"Wonderful," I said, and I meant it.
It was the petroleum jelly, of course, which held the water drop in place.
How clever of Dogger to have thought of it.
"Our objective lens," Dogger said, moving it into position just above our smudge of residue on the bottom of the glass. "What do you see?" he asked.
I bent at the waist until I was directly above the drop of water, which was illuminated from below by the torch. Several tiny grains, fringed with many colours, shimmered before my eyes.
"Are those diatoms?" I asked. "They're quite tiny."
Dogger reached into the pocket of his resourceful waistcoat and pulled out his reading glasses.
"Use these as a magnifying eyepiece."
I slipped them onto my nose and ears. Gently, so as not to dislodge the drop of water. I took the paperclip from Dogger's fingers, moving it up and down until the image in the water drop was clear.